off this prayer and motion.
Thank you, brother. So 2 Corinthians, the first half of this letter, we're dealing with Paul's encouragement at getting the response from Titus that the Corinthians had responded well to his first letter, the letter that was exhorting them to make the changes they needed, to repent. He was so concerned about it, they ended up cutting short some of the trips that he had planned. He ended up going a different direction than he had planned to go. And some who are among the Corinthians now took advantage of that as Paul being wishy-washy, saying one thing and doing something else, and began to call into question his integrity as an apostle, his integrity as a servant of the Lord. So Paul spent a good amount of time up to this point really defending the preaching, not defending himself as a preacher, but defending the preaching. And several times he's told them, I can't believe that you're seeking some kind of a commendation. I don't need letters of commendation to you as maybe some others would. You are Christians because I preached there. You believe the gospel that I taught. How are you turning away from it now? Remember that at the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, they had been denying the resurrection, some of them. And so he called them into question about that. If you deny the resurrection, then you have no faith. Your faith is vain. Because what you believed is based on the resurrection. And so they denied that, and now some have come among them and are teaching other things. We'll find out later in the letter that these are Jews. These are Judaizing teachers. They're coming along just as they were doing in the Galatian region, and the Colossian letter mentions some of them, and the Ephesians as well. They've been going through teaching that it was necessary for Gentiles to become Jews first and then Christians, and basically taking away the import of what Jesus did on the cross. His sacrifice is all sufficient. Then why would you need to become a Jew first? So Paul's been defending the gospel that he preaches as a way to prove that he doesn't need letters of commendation. The gospel is his letter of commendation. But today he'll come down to the last of these defenses. And it's really interesting the way he approaches this subject. Of course, he's still in the context of his excitement of knowing that they're doing well. And he's already dealing with this issue. And it will really be the main issue once he gets past chapters 8 and 9 dealing with the collection. It'll be the main issue for the rest of the letter is how to deal with these false teachers who are among them now and how not to be duped by them. So as we get into 2 Corinthians chapter 6, I'll have somebody read for us the first 10 verses there, and then we'll look at these questions. Who'd like to take that reading? 2 Corinthians 6, 1 through 10. Thanks, Sam.
We then as workers together with him also plead with you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, in an acceptable time I have heard you, and in the day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. We give no offense in anything, that our ministry may not be blamed. But in all things we commend ourselves as ministers of God, in much patience, in tribulations, in needs, in distresses, in stripes, in imprisonments, in tumults, in labors, in sleeplessness, in fastings, by purity, by knowledge, by long-suffering, by kindness, by the Holy Spirit, by sincere love, by the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left, by honor and dishonor, by evil report and good report, as deceivers and yet true, as unknown yet well-known, as dying, behold, we live, as chastened yet and yet not killed, as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing, and yet possessing all things.
Thank you, Sam. So he's just been talking at the end of chapter 5 about how he and these other teachers of truth are ambassadors. They're going out and they're preaching, they're pleading with men to reconcile themselves to God. And so, as he is an ambassador, what does he say he's doing, besides pleading with them, obviously? What is the simplicity of what he's doing? And Shirley pointed out that Mark 16 should have been 19 and 20. My computer sometimes makes those mistakes. But it's supposed to be verses 19 and 20 if you want to find the parallel that's better there. What is he doing as an ambassador? He's working together with them and with God. You think of that's what an ambassador's role is. He speaks for the one who sent him. And so here, as an ambassador of the heavenly kingdom, that's the idea here. You've got someone working on behalf of a nation, representing this nation. This nation, this sovereignty is God's nation. It's God's dominion. And so he's working together with God. Now, there's a reason he brings this way. He's kind of culminating all of his arguments about the fact that he doesn't need letters of recommendation. Because really, God is his recommendation. He's an apostle by the will of God, not of men. He'll make that argument also. He doesn't need any other recommendation. Chapter 12, he'll say God even showed signs through his hands. God already recommended him, or commended him to the Corinthians. The Corinthians accepted what he was teaching. And so, these others though, these others that have come along, what is their letter of commendation? You know, maybe they've got something from the Jewish school of thought, or they've got something that says they've been a Pharisee their whole life. Paul can make all those same arguments. In chapter 11, he'll make some comparative arguments and say, but I'm way more than all that. If they want to get all carnal on their arguments, I can out-carnal anybody on arguments. But we're not going to go there. So he's working together with God. That's the goal of the evangelist. Should be the goal of every Christian. That's our work. We're working together with God. I appreciate so much Craig's lesson this morning. That's it. We're working together to defend the holiness of the gospel, if you will. And this phrase, working together, Romans 8, verse 28, we know that verse pretty well. All things work together for the good of those that love God. Why? Because we're working together with him. That's what it is. It's a work that's being done here. So Paul, as an ambassador, is working together with God. And so in doing that, he's pleading with the lost, be reconciled to God. What's his plea to the Corinthians? Don't receive the grace of God in vain. Now, we're preaching to the lost. Are we going to lose ourselves? He's telling them, do not receive the grace of God in vain. As we pointed out, they've already been denying the resurrection of Christ, some of them, which made their faith vain. That's exactly the word he used back then. Now some are denying the apostleship of Paul, who taught them the gospel. That then makes their faith vain if he's not really an apostle. If that's not really the truth that he preached to them, why did they believe it? Why is that what they've been standing in? Why are they acting as though he doesn't have the accolades or the proof of an apostle, that they have to have some other kind of commendation from him? And so they're starting to follow the doctrines of men. Matthew chapter 15, what does that become? Vain worship. So if they remember even what Jesus said about following the doctrines of men, they're going to want to be careful. Is it possible to receive the grace of God in vain? Absolutely. Faith without works is dead. Faith without the works of God is not cooperating with God. It's not working together with him. It's just being religious in some way. And so he's pleading with them not to receive the grace of God in vain. And he quotes from Isaiah 49 here, verses 8 and following. I want to read just a little bit of what Isaiah says. He mentions here, an acceptable time I've heard you, in the day of salvation I've helped you. But I want you to see what else is going on in this text. Isaiah 49, thus says the Lord, starting in verse 8, in an acceptable time I have heard you, and in the day of salvation I have helped you. I will preserve you and give you as a covenant to the people, to restore the earth, to cause them to inherit the desolate heritages, that you may say to the prisoners, go forth. To those who are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed along the roads, and their pasture shall be on all desolate heights. They shall neither hunger nor thirst, neither heat nor sun shall strike them. For he who has mercy on them will lead them. Even by the springs of water he will guide them. I will make each of my mountains a road, and my highways shall be elevated. Surely these shall come from afar. Look, those from the north and the west, and these from the land of Sinim. Sing, O heaven, be joyful, O earth. Break out in singing, O mountains, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have mercy on his afflicted. It's the blessings of the preacher of salvation. This is who Paul is. He's bringing this message that brought the Corinthians from the far corners in to the fold of God. What's the urgent point that he's making here? Why say what he did in verse 8? Why quote that? What's happening with the Corinthians here?
Well, for now is the time of our salvation. Isn't it?
Yeah, God talks about the acceptable day. When is the acceptable day of salvation? Right now. And if you accept the grace of God in vain, you're putting it off. And you're going to miss your right now. That's the point he's making. This is an urgent matter. This is not something you can kind of just wait around on. This is something you've got to decide now. Are you going to follow these false apostles? Are you going to follow Christ? The ambassador is pleading. Are you going to lay down your swords and serve? Are you going to fight against what the ambassador's brought and be taken down? Be forced into submission? Don't receive the grace of God in vain. He's extending his grace to those who are willing to accept his terms. Even to these Gentiles, which are you now, Corinth, are you willing to accept it or are you going to reject it? Reject it. What's the major purpose behind the way Paul lives his life then? It's all in this same context. He's an ambassador, he's pleading with them, and it's changed his life. Again, as Craig was pointing out this morning, there's some decisions that are made on a daily basis now, since today's the day of salvation. What does he say is the reason he lives his life this way?
He's not hypocritical in his walk.
Absolutely. There's two points that he brings out here that'll sort of answer the question, at least the way I'm asking it. What is he trying to avoid doing? Yes, Chris. Yes. Is he worried about how people feel about what he's doing? He doesn't want to give offense in anything. Not the way we use the word offense, but the way Chris said it. He doesn't want to put an obstacle. He doesn't want to cause a stumbling by his life. And so he's very open. He's very transparent in his way of life. And this is the point he's going to get to in verses 4 through 10 just a moment. He wants the gospel to be seen in him. He says in Galatians, it's no longer I that live, but Christ lives in me. I want people just to see Christ when they look at me. He doesn't want to give offense so that the ministry may not be blamed. Notice he doesn't talk about himself here. He's not worried about what people think of him. He's going to say they think he's deplorable. They don't even know how to speak. He's ignorant. But he does care what people think about the gospel. And so he lives his life in such a way that the ministry, the service he does, is not blamed by what he's doing. You think about how many ministers are people that turn people away from the gospel because of their blameful, shameful attitude and shameful lives, that people will say, well, that can't be the truth of God. Look how this man lives. Paul is trying to avoid that as much as he can. He wants to be blameless, and he encourages others to serve the Lord to be blameless. He's going to use this idea later in chapters 8 and 9, talking about the blamelessness and the caution that they have when dealing with the collection. The thing about any kind of a public servant, and we as Christians are public in our service to the Lord, what kind of caution should we use when dealing with issues that might bring a stain on the ministry? Remember, Mike Pence got lambasted because he said that he wouldn't meet a woman out for lunch without his wife present. People got all over his case, and then Me Too movement broke. Well, it wouldn't have been a lot better if those people had that same kind of attitude that Mike Pence had. Yeah, Roger, sorry. Yeah, that they shouldn't be following men, they should be following the Christ, and the message he taught was about Christ, not about himself. Absolutely. And so, if we live our lives the way we should, as Christians, as servants of the Lord, then the ministry, the service that we perform, won't be stained by our lives. People will see Christ living in us. But we can cause a reason for the ministry to be blamed. We want to avoid that. Paul has made some choices that people, when we get to chapter 11 especially, people are going to say, look how crazy this man is. Look at the decisions he's made. And he says, if I'm crazy, it's because of God. If I've got common sense, it's because of you. I want you to see that what we're teaching are the words of common sense, the words of wisdom. But my crazy life, that's because I'm serving the Lord. I don't live the way other people in this world live. So he says he's not seeking to commend himself. And he said that several times. We don't need our commendation. Our commendation is from the Lord. But what way is he actually commended to the Corinthians then? Because he does mention here what his commendation is. What is that?
As ministers of God.
Yes. What, Roger? Yeah, certainly the Corinthians are, because 1 Corinthians 15, he brings that out. You are our epistle. You're the reason that we know that the truth was preached here, because you believed it. John, do you have a comment?
Just be committing themselves in who they are.
Yes, in who they are, and not just that, but in...
What I'm seeing here also is the idea we wouldn't go through all the hardships and everything that happened to us.
Yeah.
If we weren't servants of God.
That is part of it. You look at the kind of life these men lived, you know, when people try to discount the gospel as myth or something that was just made up by a small band of believers and it just happened to persist. All these men gave their lives for it. If you look at the Mormon doctrine, the original people that came up with that doctrine, many of them recanted before they died. The Jehovah's Witnesses as well. Now, the movement persisted, but a lot of the original founders said, yeah, we made this up. Certainly, Spiritism, the two ladies who first founded the Spiritist movement, they denied all of it later and said, yeah, we did all that. But their followers continued on because they believed the myth that had been created. With Christ, not one renounced. Judas was the only one, and he did that before Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. All the others were witnesses and never recanted. So, in that sense, yes, we have true witnesses in the sense that they never recanted. But what is it beyond their own character? What in this list? What does he say about themselves? It's a word that we throw around sometimes in a wrong way. Shirley said it a minute ago. What are these people? They're blameless as what? As servants, as ministers. They haven't sought for commendation, but everything that they've done shows they're servants of Christ. Everything that they've done, the way they've lived their lives, is a reflection on what they believe, and therefore they've lived the way they have. And so their commendation comes from their service. Yes, Steve? Amen. Yeah. Why should he need a letter if they have a life that's been changed by the gospel? They're proof. So Paul's service, even to them, should be proof enough. What does the word ministers mean? Throwing that around. Servants. It's diakonos here, where we get our word deacon. Deacon's a servant, but it's a servant or attendance. Even the word that was used as like a waiter at a table. It's someone who is there to serve you. That's what a minister is. So I want you to think about where Paul's going with this. He has served the church at Corinth, has he not? Yes, he has. He spent his life serving them. Chris?
So it seems like the way a lot of people have that today, wear it like a title, like I'm a minister, you give me things, you give me all whatever they ask for that they claim to be.
Yeah, we don't use the word ministers typically for our government cabinet members, but in England they do, and in Brazil they do. And you get this kind of negative taste in your mouth because minister is someone who's there to be served. They're the public servant, but they're not serving the public. They're there to be served, just like you're pointing out. And that's the way it's kind of used in religious circles. You know, someone will start off their name with Reverend so-and-so, minister so-and-so. And so it becomes a title. Is this the way that Paul and the other Bible writers are using the word ministers? Is it a title? What would we say it is? It's not a title. Adjective, it's a describing word. That's exactly what it is. By its definition, it's not a title. It's a description, just like the word Christian. Christian's an adjective. It describes someone. And so, Paul's not saying, it's my title as minister that makes you know that I'm somebody important. No, it's my ministering that helps you know that I'm serving the Lord because you see me serving. That's what, in Mark chapter 10, Jesus was trying to help the apostles with that. They're arguing who's going to be the greatest, who's going to be the greatest minister among them. And Jesus said, you know who's the greatest minister? The one who serves the most. That's what a minister does. It's not the one who carries the title, it's the one who does the service. And so Paul is saying, we have proof of our ministry because you've seen how we work. It's amazing. In the Thessalonian letter, as he speaks to the Ephesians in Acts chapter 20, and when he's talking to Timothy, you followed my way of life. You followed my service. You've seen how we do these things. In all things, we're blameless. He says it over and over and over again. He's not saying, look how great I am. He's saying, have you not noticed the way we live? You need to live that way. John?
Put it another way and say, our accommodation is our service to God.
That's it. Yeah. What recommends us? What says that we're Christians? The fact that we come in here on Sundays and we tell everybody we're Christians? What says that we're Christians is how we live our lives the rest of the time. That's what says we're Christians. Yeah.
I put together a sermon many years ago based on this thought. If being a Christian was made illegal in this country, Would there be enough evidence to convict you?
Yeah. Is it just your title, or is it who you are and what you do? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, again, there's where faith is proven by words.
And you think about even like with Daniel, when the edict went down that you couldn't pray, and he went ahead and prayed three times a day. It wasn't something he just said he did. It was something he actually did. And so he was. That's what they caught him. That's the way they knew they could catch him, because they knew that's what he'd be doing. I saw a hand over here. Okay. So they use the word minister then as a description of what they do. They're ministering. And so, again, this is a bite already toward these ministers who are among them, who are not ministering, who are being ministered to. These false apostles. There's going to be a great comparison that Paul's getting to. And when he gets chapter 11, he'll kind of bring it all together when he has that second list of all the things he's been through. But he's going to list here some details of his service. This is why he's commended before them. And it's not like Paul went out and said, okay, today I'm going to do, have some sufferings and fastings and tribulations. He didn't just kind of make a list and say, I'm going to go do these, and then people look and say, look what I did. It's he's looking back and saying, you want some proof that I'm serving the Lord? Look what my life looks like. Here it is. Here's this crazy man they're talking about because of all these things. So look at the first ones there in verse 4. He says, in these things we commend ourselves as minister to God in all things. And he mentions three things in this verse. I think there's three groups of three here. He says, in much patience, in tribulation, in needs, in distresses. There are actually four things in this group. But he mentions those things. What do tribulations, needs, and distresses all have in common? If you look at the parallel in chapter 11, there are several things he mentions there. Shipwrecks, these journeys, these perils of waters and of robbers, perils of his countrymen, perils of Gentiles, perils in the city, perils in the wilderness. What are all of those, Chris?
Things that they're going through.
Yeah, how does he get to Corinth? Either walking, where he's going to be along the road where robbers are, where his own countrymen are going to hunt him down. They've done that several times. He's on a boat, he might sink. You see that? So all these are kind of natural dangers of his service. You know, people that go to Sierra Leone to preach the gospel, they're putting themselves in a place where a lot of people would never go, but they're going there for the purpose of preaching the gospel. You might say that about Brazil or anywhere else in the world, that people just, you're exposing yourself to more natural dangers than other people who are just coming to church every Sunday. Now, I want you to think about what Paul's saying with this. Because of the life I've chosen in serving the Lord, I'm just more exposed to these things than other people are. And once Christianity becomes outlawed, he's exposed to death for even being a Christian, more than other people are because they're not Christians. But all of these things are just part of his service to the Lord. It's not like he's bragging about all this. He's just saying, these are just what are. These are just the natural things that I go through. Now, he's traveled. Someone said that Paul, in the ancient world, is the most documented traveler that we know. Now, there's a lot of people like Alexander the Great. He conquered a lot of the ancient world. But Paul traveled it more than Alexander the Great did. Paul went back and forth over all the things that Alexander had conquered many, many times. So in terms of documentation, Paul's the most documented ancient traveler we have. I think that's probably true. So in all of his travels, he's exposed much more than the Corinthians are, than any of the other Christians he's serving. That's a service he's doing for the Lord and for these Christians. So then the next group of things in verse 5, stripes and imprisonments and tumults. What do all those have in common? Then in chapter 11, there's some other of those things that are similar. He's got the 40 stripes minus one, beaten with rods, stoned. Again, perils of his countrymen and of the Gentiles. What do all those have in common? Yeah.
Things that he faces right
now. Yeah, things that are inflicted on him. He's got natural issues that he's got to deal with because he's just exposed more to the elements as he's traveling everywhere. But then, people don't like what he's teaching. And so they inflict persecution on him because of what he's teaching. Does he stop teaching? No. Chapter 4, we're hard-pressed on every side. We've got this treasure in earthen vessels. These vessels are being decaying and being done away with. Yet, even though we die every day, our inner man's renewing. He's been talking about this. That's his service. He's being persecuted for his service. He knows what that's like because he did it before. He's just paying his debt as far as that's concerned. So his stand for the truth has exposed him to these persecutional elements more than most men would be exposed. So he's exposed to the natural elements because he's always out traveling. He's exposed to persecution when others wouldn't be because he's always in people's face with the truth. And then there's a last thing. Labors sleeplessness and fastings, and weariness and toil, and sleeplessness often, and hunger and thirst, and fastings often, and cold and nakedness. What are those things? What do they have in common? They're physical things that happen. Why? Why would he be up all night? Yeah. I don't think he got through on this one, but there's an idea in one of these, the fastings possibly has it. There's another word that is not there. Sleeplessness is the word I'm thinking of. But the idea behind that is that he stayed up praying for people. That he's sleeping, that he's praying and fasting as he's praying for these other people. He's gone without food so that others could have. He's supplied the needs of those who are traveling with him, even if it means sometimes he doesn't have. He's gone without a salary. He told the Corinthians, I didn't receive from you guys. I don't want you to pay me because I don't want that to be a stone of stumbling for you. And so there are times he goes without what he needs. And then he worked with his own hands to pay for whatever he can get. So he's made these choices. These are self-inflicted suffering. These are things he's chosen to do as his service to others. So he's exposed more than other men to being overworked, to losing sleep, to going without food or other necessities. And he says in chapter 11, verse 28, besides all that, what concerns me daily? My deep concern for all the churches. Here's a man who's dedicated to serving others to the point that he's put others first in everything. So he's got the natural exposure just by all the travel he's doing. He's got persecution because of the truth that he teaches. And then his own personal choices. I want you to think about how much sleep have you lost over praying for a brother or sister who's struggling spiritually? How often have you put aside something you wanted to do so you could go sit and study with somebody who's struggling through some difficult thing? How often have you done that? We see that as preacher work, don't we? That's Christian work. I think we need to be more in tune with that idea. It makes me sad to think about the blessing that Paul has here of his deep concern for all the churches daily. Think about the blessing I've had of being in contact with so many churches in Brazil and here in the States because I happen to be a preacher. So I get invited to be with other brethren and I get to travel more. But I think what a blessing that is for me that so many of you miss out on because you just don't have the connections that I have with other people that you ought to have as family, starting here. But certainly, when you find out what's going on with Christians in other places, I know we're praying for you, that's wonderful. We need to continue doing that. But are we willing to lay down our life to stay up all night with somebody who's struggling through something terrible and to pray with them and encourage them? I believe we would. Maybe we don't realize the opportunities are there. Maybe we're not seeking them as we should. But that's a blessing that he's chosen to go without food and without sleep and without things that he needs so that others can have as he's serving. But the point of all that is not to brag. The point of all that is to say, this is what a servant looks like. You know, think about those who are forced into servitude. What does their life look like? They don't make the choices for themselves. They serve someone who tells them what to do. What if you could volunteer, Romans chapter 6 and Romans chapter 7, to be a slave to God and just volunteer your service, putting others first, God first, and then everybody else first every time? That's what we're called to do as Christians. So Paul says, I'm a servant. Look at my life. I'm a minister. What about these guys? And he'll specifically say that when he gets to chapter 11. Right now he's just kind of building that argument. What commends me is not that I say how good I am. What commends me is you can look at my life and see, wow, this man has served. In 2 Corinthians 6 verses 6 and 7, he continues in this list. He started out with the things that he suffered, the things that he's been through, even self-inflicted things because of the service. But there's other things, his own character and these weapons of his warfare. He'll specifically say that in chapter 10. What do all these things have in common? Let me read verses 6 and 7. Think about these as I'm reading through them. Think about the common element here. Purity, by knowledge, by long-suffering, by kindness, by the Holy Spirit, by sincere love, by the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left. What's the source of all of these things? God, yeah. The word from whom? From the Holy Spirit. I believe that really we're talking about God, but we're talking specifically about the Holy Spirit here. this, if you look at the list he's made, you can go find that in Galatians 5, can't you? That's the fruit of the Spirit, almost all of it there. So he's talking about how the Spirit is the one who's built his character through this service and has given him the weapons he uses to fight with. It's not me, look how great I am. It's look what God's Spirit has done in me. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 10 or so, he said that. I've worked more than all the other apostles, not me, but God working in me. I've gone in abundance. And so his service is there. So the source of his teaching and the power that he does, with which he does all this, is the Spirit of God. I love this idea of the armor of righteousness, Ephesians 6. We see that. That's the armor of God there, and the Spirit being the sword. But he talks about the armor of righteousness on the right hand, which is where you typically hold your sword, and on the left, where you hold your shield. That's the idea here. He's got offensive and defensive weapons, and he talks about that in Ephesians 6. It's an idea that comes from Isaiah and from other places as well. But this idea is he's ready for the attack and for the defense through the Spirit and through the gospel. That's what a servant looks like. That's what a soldier looks like. That's a soldier's a type of servant, right? Talks to Timothy about that. You've got the soldier who doesn't go to warfare at his own expense. You got the one who's the farmer, but he eats of the crops. So Paul talks about those kind of things. So its source is the Spirit. Now, he has a series of contrasts in these next couple of verses. Now, all this, verses 4 through 10, is his commendation. Not that I said he set out to make this list first and then went and fulfilled it. He's looking back over his life and looking at the service he provided as proof that he is a servant. And he's able to see all of these things. And so we've got a series of contrasts here, starting in verse 8, that really is, I believe, we see in the world's eyes what Paul looks like, but what it really looks like to God. That's the kind of idea we've got here. So what does the world think of him? They think he's crazy. What does God think? Well, God thinks that he's serving by honor, while the world says, well, this is dishonor. These things he teaches, you can read annals from the first century. They talk about the despicable Christians where they actually eat flesh and blood of this one they call Christus. And they think this is just some terrible thing. I mean, look at how terrible the pagan cults were. And it's terrible that these people meet together and sing hymns to this one that they consider a god. It's amazing. But it's counter to their culture. And so they consider it horrible. It's dishonor. Paul says it's really by honor. What we're doing is honorable. He says, in the world's eyes, it's evil report. We're spoken ill of everywhere we go. I love in Acts chapter 28, he gets to Rome and he goes right to the synagogue and says, hey, I want you to know that I'm here. I want an opportunity to defend myself and defend what I've been teaching. They say, well, we really haven't heard anything about you except that you're going around teaching things. We'd like to hear more. So the word of how bad he is hadn't quite got to Rome yet, so he has an opportunity there. But by God, it's a good report. The things he's doing are of good report. Philippians 4, verse 8, he says whatever things are of good report, meditate on these, doesn't he? That's the things he's doing. It's the things he's meditating on and serving in. The world's eyes, they're deceivers. He's been accused of that. In fact, it's one of the reasons he did not take money from them. They didn't want them to think he was robbing them. And so he didn't take money. But yet in God's eyes, they're true. They're as unknown. Even the Corinthians here are saying, we don't know who this guy is. What? He's well known to God. And he says it's God who's going to judge him. As dying. And again, 2 Corinthians 4, he talked a bit about that. But yet we live. We're crushed every day, but God just builds us right back up. Peter and John, they were caned, they were beaten, came out rejoicing. Paul, he's been stoned already. I mentioned that in chapter 11. Been stoned for dead. And got back up and walked back into the same city and said, you know, there's a lot of tribulation in the service of the Lord. Amazing. As chastened, and yet not killed. Yeah, I mean, the threat of death is always on them. When you go to prison in Rome's world, you don't come out. You come out as a dead man. How many times does Paul come out of prison? How many times did Peter come out of prison? When you go to prison in Rome's world, you're in there because you're going to be sentenced to death. But Peter and Paul and others, they came out of prison often because God was letting them out. They were chastened, yet not killed. They seem as people who are sorrowful. These poor, pitiable people. They don't get to take advantage of all these great things the world has to offer. Some of our friends think that way of us, don't they? Wow, you can't do this or that? I mean, you're missing out on all the fun. No, I'm not. I'm living a blessed life. What a blessing. Craig said he never saw his parents drink or smoke or any of those things that the world thinks is so great. You got to experiment all that. You got to try it all. Well, you don't. What a blessing to be shielded from those kind of things. As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. As poor, making many rich. what they're offering is the riches of the gospel. They are poor in terms of physical things, but how rich? Blessed are the poor in spirit. There shall be the kingdom of heaven. They're making many rich. They have nothing, yet they're the only ones who really understand what all this is here for. And so the Christian, using the world in its proper context, really has freedom for all things. What was the first command in the garden? You may freely eat. Now be careful with this one tree. But the rest, I made all this for you. That's exactly what the world is. God made it for our use within the proper context that he's given for us to use it. So we're the only ones who really understand that. Those who are abusing the world and abusing themselves with the world, they're the ones who are really have nothing. They're holding on to things that they can't take with them. We use the world to build our character and to build things that we will take with us, a treasure that's built up in heaven. What a blessing to know that. So look at these contrasts. Again, this is Paul the servant. That's why he's able to say all of these things. This is just what comes naturally out of serving. You look back over your life, you didn't really feel all this at the time. Nobody's going, oh, I've got to sit up all night with my brother who's suffering. Nobody thinks like that. You just do it, and you look back and you think, wow, I never noticed. You know, I went that whole day without eating. I didn't even think about food because we had so much more going on that was more important. John?
You really don't see in the list that you're not a Christian for worldly things.
Absolutely. Yeah, where's his new car? Where's his own boat that he's using to sail around? To see? None of that. This is him taking advantage of what the world has to offer as a tool in his service and suffering because of the kind of service he's offering. It's a blessing in the end. Comments or questions up through verse 10 before we go to this next small section? Roger.
My interesting thing about Paul that he was a good servant before too.
Absolutely.
So his character hadn't changed, and so he telling the world that you are like all these things they said he give up. They knew how he was. He was very well educated. He was with the highest in the Pharisees. And he said he was persecuted. So now he gave all these things up. So that kind of like put the things to them and made them even they had to deny it. Hey, you know he's been characters with before.
Yeah. I wonder how many of these false Judaizing teachers are not people that grew up with Paul and are seeing an opportunity now to excel because he had excelled beyond all his companions. Maybe they were converted finally, and now they see an opportunity, converted in the generic sense. Maybe they see an opportunity to grow. I don't know. I'm speculating here. But it's interesting that how much interaction he still has with these Jews and then with these false, these Jewish Christians, if you will. Let's look at verses 11 through 18. Somebody read those for us. We probably won't get through this whole text today. 11 through 18. But thank you, John.
11 through 18.
11 through the end. Yeah, chapter 6.
Our mouth has spoken freely to you, O Corinthians. Our heart is open wide. You are not restrained by us, but you are restrained in your own affections. Now, in a like exchange, I speak as to children, open wide to us also. Do not be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? For what fellowship is light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God, just as God said, I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate, says the Lord. And do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty.
Very good. Thank you. What is Paul's posture? What does he say his posture is, at least, as he's talking to the Corinthians? His attitude, I guess is a better word.
It says his heart is wide open, and really it's showing the sincerity of the message he's delivering.
Yeah, he's just speaking from his heart. This is one of the most heartfelt letters we've got in the New Testament. His own heart has been laid wide open. He's appealing to them from his heart, not a place of harshness. Some of the things he says are hard to hear, but he says it because he loves them. This is the tough love or whatever, I guess. But he's saying these things with an open heart and a transparent transparency that they are probably not used to with these false teachers. He's just opening everything up. So if there's constraint in a relationship, who's to blame for that? They are. Yeah. They're the ones who are making things difficult. They put doubts and restrictions in the way. It's not him. He's the same person that's been serving them and has been worried about them. It's cut short his service in Ephesus. It's cut short his service. He didn't even get to do what he went to Troas to do. He ended up having to rush off to make sure that the Corinthians were okay. And he gets there and finds out that they're upset with him because he's worried about them. It's just his heart is wide open. So what does he appeal to them to do in verse 13? And what's the basis of his appeal?
He wants them to be open. Like they are children.
Yeah. Children are typically open. They open their hearts to their fathers. He's like a father to them. He already said that in the first letter. He in the first letter berated them as infants. They were acting infantile, acting carnal. I don't think that's the point he's making here. I think the point he's saying here is, I'm your father, I've come to give you a hug, and you won't open your arms. How am I supposed to hug you if you won't open yourself to me? I'm being as open as I can be. I'm standing here just waiting for you to come and embrace me. That's the idea here. Paul's saying this letter is meant to be an embrace. Accept it that way. Open yourselves to us because I'm like your father calling you in for the hug. So what does Paul then strongly exhort them not to do? You can see him standing here with his arms wide open waiting for a hug as he's saying, there's a kind of hug you don't need. What does he tell them not to do? Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Well, we know that phrase. We hear it a lot. It's thrown around a bunch. There's a specific context. But I think it's interesting for us to look at what he's actually quoting from. I'll go quickly to Deuteronomy 22. And it's not like he just pulled this out of thin air. This is a principle that's taught back in Deuteronomy. It's actually the same principles taught in Leviticus 19, but this specific thing is not mentioned. So we'll just look at the Deuteronomy text. But he says, starting in verse 9, you shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together. Those three laws are found together. So what is the underlying point behind those original three laws as they're laid out there in Deuteronomy? What do you think of when you look at those three things? Not mixing your seed in the field, not mixing two different types of fabric, and not using an ox and a donkey on the same yoke. Why say all that? The work will be unfruitful in a practical sense. But what is in the first verse there, he used a word that doesn't seem like it has anything to do with what he's talking about here. There's no partnership there. That's one of the lessons. What would be the bigger lesson? What would that principle be pointing to in Israel? The word's holiness. He says that your land be not defiled. How would land be defiled if I happen to have corn and wheat growing in the same field? That's not going to defile anything. Not practically. Not physically. But the idea is this is an object lesson for holiness, for separation, for making a distinction. Think about how much easier it is to teach children corn is one thing and wheat is something else than to teach children a man is born a man and a woman is born a woman in today's climate where you're not what you are until you decide what you are. If you have that principle of what corn is and what wheat is and those are two distinct things, it's much easier then to make that application and say a man is what a man is and a woman is what a woman is and they're two distinct things. You see those object lessons? This is what the Jewish housewife, the Jewish mother is teaching her children as she walks through the cornfield and it's only corn. Walks through the wheat field and it's only wheat. There are two ox on the same yoke or two donkeys on the same yoke, but never a mixture. Why am I wearing only linen today? We have one thing. Now, is it a sin to wear, I don't know, linen and wool or whatever? No, not today. That was part of an old law that was being a tutor. It was teaching a principle. Is it a sin to be unholy? Yeah, that was the principle. John, you had a comment. So, the object lesson here is a lesson in holiness. Now let's go back and see how Paul applies it. First off, though, and this is where sometimes we go astray, in practical terms, what's the obvious result of yoking an ox, you can't really see it very well, and a donkey together? Look at the size of those animals. What's going to happen when that yoke starts to pull?
They don't pull equally.
So in the very
the stride of the two animals are different.
Completely different. Mm-hmm. The strength of the two animals is different. And so what you're going to get is some lopsided rows. You may end up really getting a big circle because the stronger animal is going to end up pulling the weaker one or pushing the weaker one. You're going to just get a big circle. But it's not going to do what you set out to do in practical terms. One's going to pull the other astray. Instead of making a straight and narrow furrow, yes, I use straight and narrow on purpose, straight and narrow furrow, the yoke's going to cause the animals to go in this circle. You have them struggling against the yoke together, and they won't be able to do the service that they're set to do. Obviously, there's a deeper principle. Chris, and we'll cut it short today after this.
My verse 14 says, do not be mismated with them.
Mismated. So they're actually going in and playing the principle out to its fullest. I believe that interpretation is not what Paul's talking about here in the sense of the mating as in a marriage. But yeah, there's a mismatching here. And what's happening with them is they're giving in to these false teachers. Roger, we'll have to cut it up, as I promise. We'll have to cut it here.
When you are a people holy to the Lord, your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be people for his treasure possession out of all people who are on the face of the earth, which means that even as Christians, you are chosen for a purpose.
Yes.
So a lot of people just try to misuse that for other purpose of separation. But we try to say that God chose you for his purpose.
Well, yes.
This is the world to bring out. So that's why he brings things, separation, or don't be allied with the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what men's doctrines will cause us to do always. They'll cause us to be allies with the world, even as we feel like we're allied with God, or it looks like externally. So Paul's going to really give them a hard lesson in this based on that simple principle. So that's a good place for us to stop. But Lord willing, next week we'll pick up here, and I'll go ahead and get the questions out for chapter 7 sometime during the week as well. Thank you for your comments.